It's the Science Strikes Back edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Organic Smorganic, Korean Science Fights Back, an interview with Skeptically Speaking's Desiree Shell. Let's begin episode 181.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical. The cosmos is also within us.
The sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your skeptical science and political philosopher. So Canada closes an Iranian embassy. We're cutting off diplomatic ties. I know this is a little off topic, but a little on topic, but I thought it was kind of interesting to bring up. So Ethan, what the hell's up with all this Canada closing this diplomatic embassies? Do you know anything about this?
Well, as you know, Don, I am a high-ranking spy in Canada's international intrigue world politics ministry.
An Illuminati member.
Yes. But as a member of this very exclusive organization, I cannot give you any details whatsoever on this particular turn of events.
No, and actually, I figured most people didn't know a lot about it, which is why I thought I'd broach the subject, because we do try and expand our horizons on the show. And it is kind of a big thing to cut diplomatic ties. Now, of course, usually this sort of thing is associated with one particular hang-up or another, but Iran is one of those unique cases where it's just a big pile of look that's kind of come together. I mean, everyone's kind of heard that Iran has been trying to develop nuclear power. Some say that leads to nuclear weapons. And to be fair, Israel has nuclear weapons. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. I can see it in Iran's interest to want to do that. So that's one of the things that's on the table. Iran has a horrible sort of history of human rights abuse. They have, you know, Sharia law. It's very theocratic type country. So there's another great reason. But really kind of at the heart of all this is its support for Syria and the atrocities that are going on right there, and Iran sort of turning a blind eye to it. It's ironic. Syria really has like one or two allies left in the world. There's Iran and there's Russia. In fact, recently they had a conference of the non-aligned nations in Tehran, and Egypt's new prime minister, Morsi, who is a member of the Islamic Brotherhood, and everyone was figuring, you know, he's going to come out in support of all this, you know. He came out and he just sort of said, listen, Iran is horrible for supporting Syria. The Syrian government should be thrown away. We need to support the rebels. And it was really sort of a slap in the face in Iran. Now, one of the West's responses to, one, the nuclear weapons, among other things, and its continued support for Syria, is to do economic sanctions. Now, of course, this is one of the ways that, you know, a country can exhibit pressure on another without actually resorting to force. And one of the fears is that the last time that these economic sanctions were applied, about a year ago, the British embassy was, well, first of all, the ambassador was ejected and the embassy itself was attacked and taken over for a while. So there's a bit of fear that with a new round of sanctions set to take place, that the Canadian embassy may be the one that's going to be taken over and attacked. So unlike the brave move we did during the Iranian Revolution, Canada is ducking its tail and leaving this time.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned Russia, because Russia has been the center of a lot of sort of free speech and free expression controversies in the last little while as well. I mean, the big concern was the Pussy Riot band.
Can you say that on radio?
I think I can say it because CITR is a progressive radio station. We all love CITR here. But this band, this political protest band, was sort of thrown in jail in a sort of kangaroo court. And this is kind of going along with some of the more disturbing trends that we've noticed in Russia. We've talked about this before, anti-democratic and also sort of this sort of quasi-nationalistic fever that's sort of spreading across the country. It's very disturbing. And, you know, touching on this whole, how do we as skeptics, humanists, deal with sort of international intrigue has always been, and I think it will remain for quite a long time, a very difficult question for us to confront.
Well, you know what? It's actually a great example of realpolitik in a certain degree, because, I mean, there's a lot of things that, as a sort of, you know, Kantian rule-based things, we should just treat Russia the same way we do Iran. But if we did that, I mean, Iran is a major, Russia is a much more major trade partner, Canada. Right now, we're over there trying to create another trade deal. And although morally, we should say, listen, you know, Russia, you're just as much a part of the problem. We're not. And it's cool in one sense that Russia, I mean, I was just watching the other day, Putin in one of those little ultralights leading a flock of, whooping cranes, I think it was, you know, to their summer or winter resting place, which was just, the man is so over the top. I mean, he is returning sort of the idea of dictatorship to Russia, but you have to give him bonus points for doing it with a lot of style.
Well, yeah, I suppose. But, you know, it's interesting, though. I mean, we can look at some pretty good evidence, science-based evidence, when it comes to this sort of thing. And you know, a good example is Steven Pinker's recent book, where he demonstrates that a lot of times what makes an impact on sort of these repressive nations is not when we sort of say, okay, that's it, hands off, we're not going to play. It's when we kind of actually start nudging them even more, you know, kind of poking them with an economic stick. Trade, apparently, is a really good way of building up a foundation that will, that can, in some cases, lead to more freedom and more humanist values in a nation.
I agree, and I think we should be pushing those levers more. But on the same thing about, you know, Pinker's book, if this was, you know, 50, if this was in the Stalinist age, the Pussy Riot would not have been, well, first of all, even given the choice of a sort of kangaroo court that they were, they would have just been disappeared. They would have been off in Siberia. As it was, only one of them has ended up going to jail. The other two managed to get out of the country, I believe, beforehand.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's better in that respect.
But internationally, things are not totally chaos, isn't there? Isn't there somewhere in the world where there's a bright spot?
Yes, in fact, there is. And it's South Korea, because it's in South Korea where science is fighting back against pseudoscience.
Woo-hoo!
So this is a reference to what happened a couple months ago, where a special interest evangelical group, the Society for Textbook Revise, the STR, petitioned South Korea textbook makers to remove references to evolution from high school textbooks. And they cited some trumped up ideas about creationism and intelligent design and irreducibly complex ideas, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, this sort of mobilized the science community in South Korea. And actually, it's brought about tangible results. South Korea government has urged textbook publishers to ignore these calls from the Society for Textbook Revise. So it's a pretty interesting victory. Now, they wrote up a nice article in Nature magazine about this. The offending sections of the textbooks, most of which referred to Archaeopteryx and other transitional fossils, were defended by these scientists who said, hey, listen, this is some of the best evidence we have. And they actually convened a panel, 11 members, led by the Korean Academy of Science and Technology, and including experts on evolution and fossils. And they went over all these revisions and all these complaints. And on September 5th, the panel concluded that the theory of evolution is an essential part of modern science that all students must learn in school, which is not a surprising result when you review the evidence, of course. Mm-hmm. But the great thing is that the government has decided to back the panel's conclusions, and textbook publishers will be asked to report on how they have implemented these revisions before the new textbooks roll out in 2013. Now, of course, the STR, they're not taking this well. They're claiming that the government showed bias in excluding them from this panel, and they're going to keep fighting for, quote, better science textbooks. But Duckwon Lee, president of the Basic Science Council and the panel leader, says he hopes that the panel's guidance will eventually improve public understanding of evolution. In July, there was a survey in Korea that found of 613 respondents, 45% believed in evolution and 32% believed in creationism. So those are already fairly good numbers compared to, say, like America, where it's kind of reversed. But actually, they think this might actually benefit that and improve that 45%.
No, actually, it's one of the ironies about, you know, depending on how things work in a particular country, that these groups will sometimes try and sneak in under the radar. But when you shine the light on them, the stupidity, for lack of a better word, of what they're trying to promote comes to light. I mean, I think one of the things that Korea has as an advantage is it's got a very good educational system, so that, you know, even if people will sort of, without thinking too hard, say, well, you know, I kind of maybe believe in God and that sort of thing, so maybe this isn't so bad. When these groups push the, well, evolution is false and we should get rid of it from our school curriculums, they have the scientific background to sit back and say, well, wait a minute, no, that's absolutely ridiculous. And if anything, we should be more up at arms against them. Whereas in the United States, because their levels of science education has become so low, that, you know, you don't get the same kind of pushback. You get the sort of, oh, yes, I knew that, and you're right, let's teach the debate.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is really good news, because when we discussed this before, you know, we were talking about how it wasn't really a complete victory for creationists, because it wasn't like universities were going to get shut down and biologists were going to get thrown in jail. But it was a pretty significant blow, because if you erode the state of education, that sort of leads you down that path where we see in America, where, you know, the education rates are so low and scientific literacy is so low that people are genuinely confused about evolution. They don't know that it's really an isolated case in America where you have this huge amount of public doubt. So, I mean, it's great for South Korea to sort of stop that from going too far and reaffirming what has been a very strong scientific presence in the country. And I think we mentioned before how they had some very impressive rates amongst young people coming out of high school, really knowing their stuff when it comes to science.
Well, isn't it also true, if I remember the story correctly from originally, there is no actual sort of governing body about what goes into scientific textbooks, and hasn't really, by this controversy coming up, a clear sort of ad hoc or de facto, they have now created a body responsible for this. Isn't this sort of what this 11-member panel kind of is going to do from now on?
Well, I think that they have the ability to oversee the next rollout. I mean, I guess it's going to depend on what happens. If in 2013 the textbooks come out and they're atrocious, then it might actually be a really good opportunity for them to really take a fine-tooth comb and go through them. If they come back and they're better or you know, as they were before, there may not be a lot of revision, because perhaps, you know, they were already really good to begin with. So it really, I think it's really going to depend on what happens the next couple of months. I mean, on one hand, you kind of hope that they don't even need to do it because their textbooks will not require it. If they're really, really bad, of course, then we want to see that, you know, they review them and revise them.
No, actually, and hopefully this will also put, you know, a stop on the other ones that sort of, you know, teach the controversy, like climate change. I mean, one of the things I've been doing a lot of reading recently about has been the melting of the Arctic ice cap, and, you know, how it's been decades faster than they thought it would be. And in the United States, again, with sort of the poor educational background, that seems to be, you know, continuing to erode at the educational standards, and it looks like Korea has put a stop at it. In fact, I remember I was just listening to the Skeptics Guide to the Universe, and they said something that I thought was absolutely astounding. They had that, you know, are children more likely to attribute supernatural causes to events than adults? And it turned out that adults were actually worse at it, because as we grow up, we tend to be miseducated about these sort of things. And this strikes me as one way to strike back at that.
Yeah, well, that speaks to things that I've heard James Randi mention many times, that adults are way easier to fool than children. And I think that, you know, most of our evidence indicates that as well.
Well, you know, speaking of fooling people, we're going to come back after a break, and you'll be surprised at what we might talk about, organically speaking.
Science subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, what was that allusion to?
Allusion to an illusion. The organic fable, as some are often citing it. There's a study recently published in the Annals of Internal Medicine called "Are Organic Foods Safer or Healthier Than Conventional Alternatives? A Systematic Review." Essentially, what they did is they examined four decades of research that fruits and vegetables labeled organic are, on average, no more nutritious than their cheaper sort of conventional counterparts. The study found that organic meats don't seem to offer any obvious health advantage, and they even found that organic food itself didn't seem to be really any less contaminated with things like E. coli and that sort of thing, which is always one of the things we worry about, you know, industrial food. So one of the big things that's always touted about the idea of organic foods is, A, it's more nutritious. That has actually been dealt with more studies than just this one, and this is kind of a meta-study of those. So it's kind of put the kibosh on that aspect. Another thing that it seems to have put an end to is that, well, people often think that, you know, organic food means mom-and-pop operations. And perhaps if your organic food is the mom-and-pop operations, my next comment won't apply. But organic foods is a major, major economic force in the economy. In 2010, according to the Organic Trade Association, organic foods and drink sales totaled over $26.7 billion worth of sales in the United States. I'm not sure what the numbers are in Canada, which was like 4-5% of the market. Now, small compared to the whole market, but a huge, huge profit center. And the big names are getting into organic foods. So again, it's not like mom and pop. These are industrial operations, but they're industrial and they use the O word, the organic word, to market their products. Now, you know, as I said, you know, the science says that they don't seem to offer anything. In fact, one of the things that I found was really bizarre, and this was brought up by one of our listeners, is organic eggs. And one of the mom-and-pop operations who was selling the organic eggs was surprised to find out there was actually antibiotics in the chickens that he was selling. These were free-range, non, you know, he didn't do anything about the chickens themselves. But the source of his eggs was a major company, and that company injected antibiotics to the chickens in vitro, i.e. in the egg, so that his source one was the sort of pre-juiced eggs. So many times, even if it is organic, you have to be careful. It may not truly be organic. What do you think about the whole, you know, is organic foods healthier argument?
Well, I bet you anything, Don, that the people who wrote this study must work for like Monsanto or something, because I once had this organic grape and I haven't been sick since. So
yes, I think they refer to it as Monsanto, but Monty Santo is probably okay as well.
Monsanto is awesome.
So that was sort of the one thing, right? But there is some pushback coming about this now. So the health issues about that, and actually to address the E. coli, because I hadn't actually mentioned that one, E. coli doesn't usually come from sort of the way an item is grown. It's actually the way it's sort of processed afterwards. So again, these are factory settings, and if someone has poop on their hands or something like that and they handle your lettuce, you get E. coli. So it can be spread more than just through sort of the chemical train, which is what the organics is. Now, that being said, there has been a strong movement in the sort of organic movement to try and ensure certain standard things are done. And one of the things, of course, is no genetic engineering, the elimination of synthetic fertilizers, the not using sewage or irradiation in the food's production, which are good things. And I'm not going to knock that too much, although I do take sort of umbrage at the idea of genetic engineering. One of the great joys of genetic engineering is you can, in a way, make it even more organic, because the downside to organic is you don't get the same production per foot of ground. So you actually need to use more of the environment to grow the same amount of food, Whereas if you were using a genetically engineered version of the plant, you could actually grow the same amount of food without the fertilizers, without the pesticides, and by organic standards, it would be better for you and better for the environment.
Not to mention the fact, I mean, show me a fruit or vegetable that has not been genetically modified from its original natural form. Apples, bananas, grapes, these are not how they looked like when they were first cultivated.
No, and actually that goes to the big thing, is it's almost the magic wand effect where we say, well, you know, if we did it historically, that's okay. So the fact, as you point out, the banana is nothing like the original banana. And when we do genetic manipulations in a lab, it speeds up evolution, but it doesn't really alter it. I mean, there's a lot of limitations as to what you can do. Genes are not infinitely manipulatable. So whatever happens has to happen within a certain degree. It also ignores the fact that there's a lot of sort of genetic manipulation that happens with things like bacteria. More and more research into the way bacteria interact with the human body and all that, we find that it's possible for certain degrees of genetic information to sort of swap, be shifted out from one source to another. So again, you know, there's a thing there. But there was another argument that I hadn't really thought about that led me to say, wow, well, maybe this isn't such a – maybe organics do have another advantage, is that – well, we talked about the environment, but one of the parts in the environment are the people who are actually growing the food. Now, most of the studies did show that, you know, there are less pesticide residue on organic foods, but not so much as to make a huge difference. And if most people wash their fruits and veggies before they eat them, that's not a big issue. But the people who are actually growing the food and vegetable get exposed to a lot of these sort of environmental hazards in mass, in large part. And that actually can have a detrimental effect on their health. Researchers in Mexico looked into pesticide exposure of farm workers, and they found that 20% of the field hands so showed acute poisoning, and that, you know, children in some of these communities suffered severe or slight mental impairment because of the poisoning involved. Now, part of that may not be so much the herbicide or pesticides being used, but the way it's being used, because in the world's race to the bottom, regulations on how things are handled are being destroyed as well. But it does. It was one aspect I hadn't actually ever thought about, is that, okay, even if we had a level playing field and we ignored all the health sort of benefits, the health of the worker itself is an interesting one. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it's interesting, but at the same time, like in an ideal world where we are using GM foods to increase crop yields and nutrition, and we are using factory farming to produce huge quantities of food to feed our huge quantities of people. I mean, I think that you would ultimately try to remove human beings from a lot of the process. You would have massive greenhouses that were growing these foods at an accelerated rate. You wouldn't have a lot of people handling the food or being exposed to fertilizers or pesticides or whatever it is they're putting in there. And you wouldn't really have that level of exposure, because as you say, it's quite a bit different if you're crop dusting a field and you get a gust of wind and it blows toxic gas over a farm versus having it, you know, very carefully and very precisely administered through a, you know, industrialized process.
Which I guess goes back to one of the points that I had mentioned previously on episodes again ad nauseum, is quite often it's not so much the what is being used, but the how, and why there's an important issue as far as regulations and how regulations can actually make the world a better place to grow. I'm not a huge fan of synthetic fertilizers of and on themselves, but as long as they're well regulated and they're properly administered, they seem to be, if not a necessary part of life, a positive aspect to life, as in the world is growing. There's more and more and more people. And to certain degrees, it's almost impossible to grow enough food to feed all these people without resorting to these sort of non-organic measures. And ultimately, if we want to have a more equitable society, we have to say, okay, these are the tools we have. Let's make them as effective as we had. And if people are so much against pesticides and herbicides and fertilizer, then lighten up on the genetic engineering. If you think genetic engineering is the scourge of the planet, then you got to lighten up on the herbicides and fertilizers and such.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker. When we come back, we will have an interview with Desiree Schell, who is the host of the podcast radio show Skeptically Speaking, and she's going to be in Vancouver later this week for a lecture and workshop, so stay tuned for that.
That'll be nice.
It'll be very nice.
Standing on a planet, really I'm just a speck, compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Freethinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
More glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise.
Joining us now on Radio Freethinker is Desiree Schell. She is the host of the radio show Skeptically Speaking and will be in Vancouver later this week for some talks for CFI Vancouver. Welcome to the show, Des.
Very nice to be here, Ethan.
So you're in town for a lecture and workshop this week. Tell us a bit about these topics.
Well, the lecture itself is called Out of the Blogs and Onto the Streets, What Skepticism Can Learn from Social Movements. And that, in a nutshell, skeptics are really young in terms of social movements. And I do think it's a social movement, maybe a scattered one, but a movement nonetheless. And I think that there's a lot that we can learn from older social movements like the civil rights movement and feminism, even environmentalism and the LGBTQ movement. They've been down the same path as we have. And there's a lot of things that we can learn from them if we actually pay attention.
And you're doing a workshop, Effective Skeptical Activism. So where did you learn about all this activism stuff?
Oh, I've been doing this a long time. And if I think about how long, it's actually kind of depressing. But I've worked in the anti-poverty movements. I've worked with Aboriginal organizations. And for the last over 5 years, I've actually worked for a union here in Alberta. And so I'm an organizer. So what that means is I'm someone that goes in and helps unorganized work sites that want a union actually become one. And sort of on the other side of that, I develop activist campaigns around different issues that that either can affect social change or can help people in their workplaces.
Okay. And so how did you get involved with skepticism?
Well, I think that's, I think personally that it's a logical extension from social justice to skepticism, because they both rely heavily on critical thinking faculties. And once you start seeing all the flaws in sort of the public responses to things and a lot of so-called evidence that people are offering you for believing things, once you start noticing the flaws in that kind of logic, political logic and social justice logic, you start to see it everywhere. It's one of those things it's almost highly addictive when you look around and you're like, oh, I may have been wrong.
Yes, being wrong, that is one of the hallmarks of being a skeptic, apparently. So were you always skeptical? Was there an awakening moment where you stopped believing in, say, UFOs and Bigfoot?
I've been asked that before, and I don't think there's a specific point. I've always been, I'm a very curious person by nature, and that really extends to everything. I'm someone that's actually never believed in God, and I would have called myself agnostic for years, and it's only recently that I started using the term atheist. I've always tried to look for evidence for my beliefs and opinions, but I haven't always known where to look. So that's one of the things I like to help people with.
Okay. And is that why you chose a podcast?
Absolutely. There's, especially, I know a lot of wonderful, wonderful progressive people. But as you know, as you live in Vancouver, as I used to, sometimes progressives tend to fall for certain kinds of conspiracy theories in pseudoscience, tending towards sort of alt-health. There's a lot of 9/11 truthers mm-hmm. amongst the lefties. And I realized that there's sort of a service that I can do to my lefty people.
Oh, okay. So it's sort of like consumer protection then?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. And your show, I mean, I love it. You guys do a great job of popularizing science. And the thing is, your background's not science. Neither is mine. And I do a podcast too. So why are we doing podcasts and why aren't the scientists doing the podcast?
Oh, that's a great question, Ethan. I think, honestly, a lot of scientists, and this is overwhelmingly a generalization, but I think a lot of scientists have been busy doing science, really. Mm-hmm. Either they haven't been interested in learning how to communicate that to the public, or they just haven't had time. Time and interest, I think, is the two big things. But there are scientists that are trying to popularize science, but I think you can only do one or the other effectively.
Right. One of the things that I've always wondered about is I think science is better served when the public is more engaged and interested. It's not always engaging to list facts and figures. So, you know, how do we make the public be curious and be skeptical about learning new things?
I think you have to make it relevant to them. You have to look for how it actually affects people in their daily lives. So issues, like you said, of consumer protection, those are overwhelmingly popular because everyone's cheap. And I think that's great. But the other way that you can go about it is just to make it entertaining. Make it accessible to people. Don't treat science like it is something that only the very intelligent or the very well-educated have access to, because it's not. Science isn't a bunch of people in lab coats doing research. Well, that's part of science, but that's not all science is. And we can find science in everything. For example, I'm interviewing this Sunday Tom Levinson, who's the author of Measure for Measure. And it's a book about, well, I guess it's sort of a tour of science history from the perspective of certain musical instruments. Which is a very fresh way of discussing those kinds of topics, and they might actually attract people who are interested in music more than they are science.
And that's a great way to sort of bridge that gap, that knowledge gap that exists. I mean, I can't do incredible feats of biology and chemistry, but I can love to learn about the history of science and music. That's amazing.
And that's really what I look for when I'm trying to find guests for the show. People that look at science in a different way, or sort of the intersection of science and art, or science and social issues. There's so many different ways that we can get people interested in science. It just takes a bit of creativity.
Speaking of bridging those gaps, let's talk a bit about skepticism and union activism. How do we compare our two movements here? How do they stack up?
There's lots of different ways that that we can evaluate the success of different movements. And that's why I don't know if we can really compare the movements themselves, but it's the behaviors and the actions and the events within the life of those social movements that you can compare, which is why I talk so much in the workshop and in the lecture about single issue campaigns, because those are things that you can more directly evaluate and compare.
Well, you mentioned the purpose of having these clear goals and objectives. Why does that make a tangible difference when you're trying to do activism?
I find that sometimes people don't actually know what their objective is. And that's totally understandable, because when we see something happen, something that we find questionable or something that we find abhorrent in social movements or in regards to social justice, and we want to change it. That is a wonderful instinct. I would like everyone to have that instinct. But before you go jumping on out there, what actually do you want to achieve? Because changing the world is a wonderful broad goal. But how can you tell if you've changed the world? We have to figure out objectives amongst ourselves in every social movement. What can we win? What are the winnable issues? And that should be our objective, because then we have something to actually show us if it worked or not.
The skeptic movement perhaps it's a strength, perhaps it's a weakness, but it does seem to be very diverse in terms of goals and objectives. I mean, some want to focus on alt-med, some on secular issues, and some people just want to get together in a pub. So with all these, you know, wide range of issues, can the skeptical community have cohesive goals?
Single issue campaigns, my friend. That's I love the idea that everybody has different interests, different things that they find important and they want to take action on. Fantastic. Everyone should be doing that. We should have more of that. The idea that everyone has to do the same thing, I think is detrimental, because there are lots of people that won't want to get involved in, let's say, something like the 1023 campaign on homeopathy. There are just some people that are never going to want to do that. So if everybody is only doing that, there's going to leave potential activists out in the cold. But if we have many people doing many different kinds of projects, as long as they try to make those events and actions as focused and as potentially successful as possible. And one of the things I'll be talking about in my lectures is I don't really like the idea of public awareness campaigns. So we'll definitely talk about that. I don't want to give too much away.
Yes, keep it a secret. Well, I mean, there's so much to talk about within organized skepticism from a point of view of making things happen. And I wanted to get your opinion on a couple, I guess you could say, controversies that have been happening in our sort of quote-unquote movement. For example, anti-harassment policies. Good thing, bad thing. What do you think?
Oh, well, I think that's obviously a good thing. That being said, are they right for every situation? How are we going to measure that? The idea that I don't think it's ever a bad idea to have an anti-harassment policy, ever. Is that the best answer to different situations? But what are we basing that on?
You mentioned that, but there are skeptics out there who are making the argument that harassment policies are bad things and that they alienate people who want to harass people or something. So
I think you've answered your own question, Ethan.
Yes, I think I have. I do that sometimes. Okay, well, how about the recent talk about things like Atheism Plus, combining atheism and social justice?
I have done that for a long time. So I am supportive of that idea. When it first started making its way across the blogosphere, I was trying to figure out what is different. Why is that different from secular humanism? And I think I think it does come from a different place. This is the desire to make a safe space for the people who are already atheists. They want to build a community where they can have these kind of conversations without feeling like they need to go right back to the start and explain things like, you know, feminism 101. But that being said, I think you can do good social justice work without calling yourself Atheist Plus. Just go do it.
Right.
That'd be great.
Do you think it's divisive?
I think how a lot of people are dealing with it could be divisive, but I don't think the idea itself is divisive. At least not like it was originally intended. Because what I see from it is that we're trying to make an inclusive community for a very specific subset of people who did not feel included.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel like that's a bad thing. Okay. I feel like that's positive. But I try not to go on the internet. I know it's not a happy place, social media.
No, it's
and I
not.
Understand there's a lot of different opinions on that. But it's if people are arguing about whether social justice is a good thing, I don't really want to have that conversation because we all know where I stand.
Right, absolutely. Well, that leads to my next question. I mean, the skeptics, we love to argue about everything, apparently.
Oh, indeed.
So do we do that too much, though? I mean, should we not be presenting a more unified front?
You know, that's funny that you mentioned that, because I just sent Melody Hensley of CFI DC, I believe. She's running the Women in Secularism conference. And I just sent her a panel idea on that very topic, because I would like to have the conversation about how we can actually discuss ideas like this in a way that isn't divisive. And I don't know if there's any way to do that. And I don't think necessarily divisiveness is a bad thing inherently. I think there's some divisiveness that is going to happen, and I think it actually could help the health of the community. But if there are ways that we can go about this that are going to be more effective and get more people on board with what I think is a pretty good idea in a lot of ways, I would like to figure out what those are. So I'd love to have some panelists talk about their experiences with that. So well, Melody, if you're listening, please have that panel.
So then if I take what you mean, there is, you are having that debate about whether or not our way of communicating with each other is effective.
I would think this is, like I say, Atheism Plus itself was, I think, aimed more internally than externally. It was aimed at the people who are already self-identifying atheists. And I think that, you know, I don't want to have the tone conversation, because the tone conversation is mighty boring in a lot of ways. I think if we could figure out ways to have mutual respect and give people the benefit of the doubt in this community on all sides, that would be grand.
Okay, well, right now, and this taking a look at the skeptics community, what concerns you the most?
I think we have a lot of people talking about what should be done and not enough people doing, in my opinion. And that's not to say that there aren't people doing things, because there are. There are a number of wonderful groups and wonderful actions that are happening. But I would like more of that. And I think that's one of the problems at this point in our community, is that people are afraid to go outside of their comfort zone, because I think a lot of people assume that they're going to get bashed by one faction or another. And so we have a lot of, I think that people are just standing back and waiting for someone else to do something that maybe they can join in with. But everybody can be that person who starts something. It just requires planning if you want to do it right.
And what are you overly optimistic about in our skeptics community?
Oh, God. You may have to cut this part. Let me think. Optimism. Focus on optimism. I think there are a lot of very interesting conversations right now on a number of different levels. I think that there are a lot of people who assumed for the longest time that there were sort of leaders within the community, high-profile people, and they were the people that sort of set the agenda for the community. And I think that kind of perspective on the community is going away. And we see lots of people that maybe have never spoken at a conference. They've never done a public presentation, but they're speaking very loudly about issues that are important to them. And regardless of whether I agree with them on those issues, I'm very happy people are feeling the need to get involved in one way or another.
Excellent. It's the advent of the Web 2.0, giving people a voice who didn't have one before.
That's the good side. And then there's the other people. And that's, you know, when we can have civil conversations while disagreeing, I think that's the goal. But the internet definitely is, with its cloak of anonymity, it often brings out the worst in people, and civil discourse kind of goes out the window. Mm. And again, that's not in all cases, and I think we can all do better at that. Or you can do like me and just never go on Facebook or Twitter.
Well, that would work, but
that works too.
Yeah. Well, okay, maybe to end on a bit of a lighter note, who was the better skeptical writer, Carl Sagan or Christopher Hitchens?
Oh, you're killing me. I'm going to have to say Sagan.
Nice. That is the right answer. It's a true question. Well, Des, thank you for joining us, and we look forward to seeing your lecture and your workshop. The lecture is happening Friday, September 14th at 7 p.m., room 1700 of SFU Harbor Center here in Vancouver, and the workshop is Saturday the 15th at 2 p.m., room 2245 SFU Harbor Center. And maybe just give us one little teaser. What's the most surprising thing that we're going to learn after this weekend of skepticism?
Oh, I'll give you something good. That at one point in my presentation, I do indeed compare P.Z. Myers to Malcolm X.
I am so surprised by this. I can't wait.
I thought you'd like that one.
That is awesome. All right. Well, Des, thank you for joining us, and please join us again in the future.
Will do. Thanks, Ethan.
Science is more than a body of knowledge. It's a way of thinking, a way of skeptically interrogating the universe. If we are not able to ask skeptical questions, to be skeptical of those in authority, then we're up for grabs.
Canada pays some of the highest cell phone fees in the industrialized world. And now the big three companies that control 94% of the market want us to pay more? Using high-priced lobbyists, the big three are trying to trick the government into shutting out independent competitors. If they succeed, they will squeeze more money out of your wallet and squeeze Canadians into tighter contracts. Send a message to the industry minister. We want competition. We want independent providers. Stand up. Sign this urgent petition. Visit stopthesqueeze.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. Our thanks to Des for joining us for a fun segment. Now, remember, if you're in the Vancouver area, you can see Des's lecture and workshop. And that brings us to our skeptical highlights. And of course, the first one is Out of the Blogs and Onto the Streets, What Skepticism Can Learn from Social Movements. The CFI Vancouver lecture by Desiree Schell, happening Friday, September 14th at 7 p.m. in room 1700 of SFU Harbor Center, downtown Vancouver. And of course, it's about organized skepticism. We're currently at a crossroads. We're making public progress, but we have internal and external challenges that could prevent us from affecting real change. So we're going to learn about ways that we can adopt these change and the changes that we've seen in social movements who have gone down this path before. There was a suggested donation of $2 to $10 to attend. And the next day, we have Effective Skeptical Activism with Desiree Schell. This is the workshop presented by CFI Vancouver on the 15th at 2 p.m. in room 2245 of SFU Harbor Center. And again, Des will be going through a point-by-point, step-by-step interactive workshop on how to do effective skeptical activism, how to create campaign strategies and tactics, and how to explain these methods and use them on issues like vaccinations, homeopathy, and evolution education. Admission is $20 and includes a copy of Desiree's guidebook, Skeptical Activism.
Excellent. That sounds like a very fun thing to go up and show up and enjoy. I've got three kind of skeptic highlights today, and I'm spreading them out in different media. So one is a video highlight. Science Friday has To the Bat Cave. Essentially, it's a video by biologist Nikola Harstov of the UNC Center for Design Innovation at Salem State University. It's one of those like really, really pretty videos. It's of bats coming out of their cave and a few other pictures of bats flying, but it's done in like ultra slow motion. And people might often think of bats as sort of the scary thing that attacks you in the middle of the night. But if you take a look at this, you look back and you go, wow, that's beautiful. So I just thought I would share that. It's one of the things I came across this week. Another thing that I came across, which is a different thing, is some people out there may have heard of Flatland, A Romance in Multi-Dimensions. It's a 1984 sort of satirical novella by Edwin Abbott. Well, it's available free. There's been a third edition that's been made available. So people can download and read this classic sort of work in geometry and dimensions. And it's just a fun thing to sort of check out. The third thing, and I don't think I've mentioned this before, but in case I hadn't, I thought I will mention it again. One of the things that we may be going a bit more into in the future is sort of where skepticism can go and how it can be applied more effectively in other dimensions, which, of course, is a reoccurring theme of this show all the time. Now, one of the things I came across was a paper by Ben Galore about it's a cabinet paper given to the British government that advocates the use of sort of randomized blind trials for public policy. So you've got like 100 wards and you're trying to figure out which sort of back to work program works good. Well, you give each one a slightly different sort of program and you find out which one has the best results, trying to control as much as you can for the different variables. It's one of those things that very seldom does anyone actually try and apply the scientific method to public policy. And it's a very good read. It's available at badscience.net. I'm going to have a link on our website. check it out. I'm sure you'll find it quite interesting. And who knows, it might expand your mind and your dimensions and thinking about skepticism.
Always a good thing.
Yes.
Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. Your horizon of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of exquisite interrelation.